Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Warfighter, the story of an American fighting man, by Colonel Jesse L. Johnson, with Alex Holstein, narrated by Corey M. Snow. Publisher's note: this audiobook may refer to visual elements included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I, send me." Isaiah, chapter 6, verse 8. Principal Participants: the United States Armed Forces. General Colin Powell, Chairman, Joint Chiefs of Staff, Gulf War. General H. Norman Schwarzkopf, Commander-in-Chief, Coalition Forces, Gulf War. General Carl E. Vuono, Chief of Staff, U.S. Army, Gulf War. General Chuck Horner, Commander, Coalition Air Forces, Gulf War. General Buster Glosson, Deputy to General Horner. General Peter Shoemaker, Commanding Officer, Delta Force, Gulf War, later Army Chief of Staff, Iraq War. General David Petraeus, 2nd Lieutenant, U.S. Army, Italy, later 4-star General, Director of the CIA. General Carl Steiner, CNC, SOCOM, Gulf War. General Wayne Downing, Commander, RSOC, Gulf War. General John Abrams, Office of the Army Chief of Staff, Gulf War. General David C. Jones, Chairman, Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dozier Affair. General Ann Dunwoody, first woman to attain 4-star rank. General Creighton Abrams, father of John Abrams, Commander, U.S. Military Forces, Vietnam, 1968-1972. General Andrew Goodpaster, Deputy Commander, U.S. Military Forces, Vietnam, 1968-1969, later SASUR NATO. General L.V. Roberts, Brigade Commander, 1st Cavalry Division, later Assistant Division Commander, 9th Infantry, Vietnam. General William Knowlton, Assistant Division Commander, 9th Infantry, Vietnam, later Superintendent, West Point, father-in-law of General Petraeus. Admiral John McCain, Jr., CNC, Pacific Command, father of POW, future Senator John McCain III. Vice Admiral Thomas Kinbrew, European Command, Dozier Affair. Colonel Rod Paschal, Commanding Officer, Delta Force, Dozier Affair. Colonel Norm Moffat, Commander, SOF Europe, Dozier Affair. Colonel Chuck Vossen, Defense Attaché, Rome, Dozier Affair. Colonel Charles A. Beckwith, Founder, Commanding Officer, Delta Force. Colonel James Jim Kyle, Commander, USAF Component, Eagle Claw. Colonel Henry Hank Emerson, Commander, 1st Brigade, 9th Infantry, Vietnam. Colonel Harold Hal Moore, Commander, 3rd Brigade, 7th Cavalry, Vietnam, author, We Were Soldiers Once, and Young. Colonel Billy J. Miller, Helicopter Pilot, U.S. Army, Grenada, Vietnam. Lieutenant Colonel Richard Cody, Lead Pilot, Task Force Normandy, Gulf War, later 4-star General. Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Thompson, 5th Special Forces Group, SFG, Gulf War. Lieutenant Colonel Blank Frank Tony, 3rd SFG, Gulf War. Lieutenant Colonel Carl Savory, Delta Senior Surgeon, Eagle Claw. Lieutenant Colonel Joe Stringham, Commander, 1st Ranger Battalion, Delta Exercise. Lieutenant Colonel James Lindsay, 9th Infantry, Vietnam, later 4-star General. Lieutenant Colonel Don Schroeder, Commander, 2nd of the 39th, 9th Infantry, Vietnam. Lieutenant Colonel David Hackworth, Commander, Hardcore Battalion, Recondo, 9th Infantry, Vietnam, later famous author, journalist. Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Herbert, renowned hero and witness to war crimes, Vietnam. Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth D. Martell, Commander, 8th, 1st Cavalry Division, Vietnam. Major Logan Fitch, Commander, Bravo Squadron, Delta Force, Eagle Claw. Major Lewis Bucky Burris, Operator, A Squadron, Delta Force, Eagle Claw. Major John Carney, USAF Combat Controller, Eagle Claw. Major Earl Witcher, Pocahontas Hometown Hero, Three War Veteran. Lieutenant Commander Michael Williams, Navy Intel Officer, Gulf War. Captain Wade Ish Ishimoto, Delta Intel Officer, Eagle Claw. Captain Jin Tate, Company Commander, Airborne School. Captain Roy Martin, Commander, Company Bravo, 1st of the 8th, 1st Cavalry Division, Vietnam. Captain Stone, Intel Officer, 8th Cav, Vietnam. Captain Wilkie, Artillery Fire Control Officer, 8th Cav, Vietnam. 1st Lieutenant Ronald McLean, USMC, Da Nang, stepson of actor Jimmy Stewart. 1st Sergeant Virgil Top Green, Charlie Company, 2nd of the 39th, 9th Infantry, U.S. Army, Vietnam. Rubio, Ranger, U.S. Army, Eagle Claw. Wide Hat, Sergeant, U.S. Army, Vietnam. Cohen, Sergeant, U.S. Army, Vietnam. Durheim, Sergeant, U.S. Army, Vietnam. Williams, Sergeant, U.S. Army, Vietnam. Bay, Sergeant, U.S. Army, Vietnam. Clemens, Sergeant, U.S. Army, Vietnam. Dolby, Specialist, U.S. Army, Vietnam, Recipient Medal of Honor. Romero, Specialist, U.S. Army, Vietnam. Bowman, Private, U.S. Army, Vietnam. Sterp, Private, U.S. Army, Vietnam. Chavez, Private, U.S. Army, Vietnam. John Steele, Private, U.S. Army, World War II, Mission Boston. The United States Government. Jimmy Carter, President, 1977 to 1981. George H.W. Bush, Vice President, 1981 to 1988. President, 1989 to 1993. Dick Cheney, Secretary of Defense, 1989 to 1993. Alexander Haig, Secretary of State, 1981 to 1982. Admiral Stansfield Turner, Director of Central Intelligence, 1977 to 1981. Sam Nunn, Senator, Armed Services Committee, Gulf War. Lieutenant General James M. Gavin, U.S. Ambassador, France, 1961 to 1962, former Commanding General, 82nd Airborne. Maxwell Robb, U.S. Ambassador, Rome, 1981 to 1989. Peter Bridges, Deputy Chief of Mission, Rome, 1981 to 1984. Edward Skip Nem, U.S. Ambassador, Kuwait, Gulf War. Barry, CIA Chief of Station, Saudi Arabia, Gulf War. Major Richard Dick Meadows, CIA Ground Team, Tehran, Eagle Claw. Harold, CIA Officer, Eagle Claw. Al, Iranian CIA Asset, Eagle Claw. The VIPs. Ross Perot, Texas Billionaire, Military Booster. Johnny Bench, Hall of Fame Baseball Player. Bob Hope, Hollywood Star, USO Performer. Anne Margaret, Hollywood Star, USO Performer. Jimmy Stewart, Hollywood Star and Brigadier General, USAF. Gloria McLean Stewart, wife of Jimmy Stewart, mother of Lieutenant Ronald McLean. The British. General Sir Michael Mike Rose, Commanding Officer, 22nd SAS Regiment, 1979 to 1982. Colonel Andrew Massey, Operational Commander, UK Special Forces, Gulf War. Sergeant First Class Stu O'Neill, SAA Observer, Eagle Claw. The Saudis. King Fahd bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, King of Saudi Arabia, Gulf War. Captain Prince Fahd bin Turki Al Saud, Liaison, Saudi Special Ops, Gulf War, later Lieutenant General, old friend. The Kuwaitis. Sheikh Jaber al-Hamad al-Sabah, Emir of Kuwait. Sheikh Saad al-Sabah, Crown Prince. General Jaber al-Sabah, Chief, Kuwaiti Security Service, old friend. Sheikh Nawaf al-Sabah, Foreign Minister. Sheikh Salem al-Sabah, Interior Minister. Sheikh Fahd al-Hamad, Resistance Fighter, Expert Marksman. Family and Friends. Daley Johnson, my father. Lorene Hattie Petit Johnson, my mother. Daley Odine Daley O. Johnson, my big bro. Lois Johnson, my sister. Mona Johnson, my sister. Betty Johnson, my sister. Judith Johnson, my wife. Tambra, Felicia, Shannon, our daughters. Aunt Ann Pittman, former Civil War era slave, family friend. Greeny Pittman, her son, family friend. Uncle Bill White, former Civil War era slave, family friend. Aunt Josie White, his wife, former Civil War era slave, family friend. Others. Hosni Mubarak, President of Egypt, 1981 to 2011. Ehud Barak, Israeli commando, later Prime Minister. Colonel Ulrich Wegener, founder, commander, German GSG-9. Prologue. My Enemy. October 15, 1968. Brigade S3 Air, 1st Brigade, 9th Infantry Division, en route to Firebase Moore, somewhere over the Mekong Delta, Republic of Vietnam, 11:54 a.m. I held the man's bloodless gaze. Dull fade in his eyes, I knew he was finished. Still breathing. Not for long. I could tell by the way his chin spasmed, off each gasp of air, as though to the broken rhythm of his heartbeat. Something about that bothered me. I don't know why. I'd seen plenty of people go that way. My own men. This one was different. Dusting off the pickup zone, our chopper shaved the treetops, AK rounds plinking the fuselage, parting shots from his comrades nestled deep in the sprawling jungle below. And there the dying man was, on the cabin floor, laid out at my tired feet. This captain of the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army, his left side shot up pretty bad. Blood coated his skin like dark honey. It was pouring out of him now. I held his gaze fast. Colonel Gerasi, my commanding officer, CO, was on the battalion net, calling ahead to make sure there'd be a medic on the pad ahead of our arrival. Not that it would do any good. I thought about how I had been making it through this war, waking up every morning and telling myself that if I could just make it till noon, I'd be good for the rest of the day. I'd make it home. This guy wasn't going to make it home. In a moment, all sound drowned out to a distant echo, and an eerie quiet fell over the cabin, and I realized we were flying with the troop doors slid shut. Normally, we flew wide open both sides, all this brutal wind kicking up, door gunners ripping bursts off their M60s or miniguns, the thud of rotor blades, people shouting, radio static, the wild cacophony of warfare. Maybe it was just me, ears tuning out all that background noise, but somehow the silence seemed to crash over me like thunder. The dying man never made a sound. Never so much as grunted. Never let his eyes leave my own. Face soaked in pain. I wondered what kind of pain it was, what his mind was holding on to just then. Regret? People? Those he'd be missing? Worrying about in his last minutes of life. Wife, children, the war he'd given them all up for. Slow and shaky-like, his arm rose toward me. Bloodied fingertips brushed against my wrist, trembling in their thirst for human contact. I hesitated. Then his hand took harbor in my own, and I tightened my grip around it, holding it there. In that moment, I was not giving comfort to the enemy. He was no longer the enemy, and I was no longer his. The war between us was over for all time. I was deep into my second tour in Vietnam, and I had received several of our nation's highest decorations for taking the fight to the enemy and killing them. God knows how many of that man's brethren I had slain. I had shot them, called down artillery and airstrikes on their positions, obliterated them right off the face of the earth. For that last silent moment, I held this dying man's hand because he was a fellow soldier, fighting for his country and now laying down his life for it. I held his hand until his last breath left him, and then I let him go gently, and placed his arm back across his body and slid my palm over his eyes and closed them. I looked at my watch. It was 12:05. 1. Air Mobile. 1. Gung Ho NCO. September 21st, 1965. 1st Battalion Airborne, 8th Cavalry. 1st Cavalry Division, Air Mobile. Camp Radcliffe, 2nd Corps. An K. Central Highlands, Republic of Vietnam. The first time I got shot at was at An K. That was my first night in Vietnam. First night of my first tour. First time in combat, if you could call it that. Combat. This was more like a taste test, baby steps. First time and all. The heavy contact was just around the corner. Kind of a weird relief, though, getting shot at. We'd been expecting it from the moment we hit the beach down at Quy Nhon, finally put our boots on the ground in Vietnam. That tornado of bullets. By then, the enemy had gone through periods of killing almost a full battalion of South Vietnamese per week. In a war of attrition, they were already way ahead. Just one of the big things that set this war apart from all those before it. This wasn't even your standard North versus South type of deal, like Korea, or our own civil war. The South Vietnamese weren't holding any line because there was no line to hold. We would be fighting an enemy that was already dug in all around us, a shadow occupation force that had us completely encircled from within and without. The so-called National Liberation Front, better known as the Viet Cong. Charlie, we called him, or her. Plenty of women in their ranks. For the uninitiated, Charlie came from the initialism VC, which in the NATO phonetic alphabet was Victor Charlie, or just plain old Charlie. Their pals in the NVA we called regulars, seeing as they were the regular North Vietnamese army, but most of the time we referred to them as Charlie too. Charlie North and Charlie South, Charlie all around, even if we couldn't see him or her. What we had walked into was the Southeast Asian version of the Alamo. We were surrounded, hadn't even hit the battlefield and already getting shot at. This was the real deal. So if there was one thing that became crystal clear to us at that baptism of machine gun fire raining down from all those shadows on the mountain above us, it was that Charlie, North and South, meant business. This was war. Still, you could say, laying down fire on us that first night, right down onto our brand new base, they were doing us a favor, keeping us sharp, riding that razor's edge. And if there was one thing they would soon discover about us, it was this. We meant business, too. The cavalry had arrived. In that moment, I was ready, or about as ready as any man could be, anyway. Fear was just another mortal enemy I had learned to conquer. Jumping out of airplanes kinda teaches you how to do that, real fast. I was a gung-ho NCO, eager to kick ass for my country. I was a jumping Mustang, a paratrooper in the legendary 1st Cavalry Division, spearheading a whole new type of warfare, air mobile, riding helicopters instead of horses into battle to attack the enemy at a time and place of our choosing. But it wasn't the choppers themselves that would bring fear to our friends from the north. That's something a lot of historians in Hollywood movies get wrong. And boy, have they gotten a lot wrong about Vietnam. It was what those choppers were delivering to the battlefield. Us. American soldiers. The best led, best trained, best equipped fighting force in the history of warfare. H hour. One orange soda and 100 push-ups. Most Americans had spent the last couple of months going to barbecues and ball games, doing all that good kickback summer stuff. We'd spent them training under the hot southern sun at Fort Benning, Georgia, getting all amped up and wired tight for this moment, the first deployment of a full 16,000-strong division of the United States Army to Vietnam. We had trained hard, day in, day out, round the clock, rifle drills on the range to make us one with our brand new M16s, full-blast physical training and Ironman-style runs to get us in shape for the harsh terrain and diabolical swelter of the jungle, live-fire artillery exercises, escape and evasion, land navigation, maneuver warfare, tactical engagement, you name it. And we jumped, which was more fun than anything else. At least it was for the die-hard airborne NCOs like myself, who'd been brought in from the 82nd and 101st to train and qualify up as many of the straight-leg non-jumpers as we could. Last 30 days we'd spent at sea, from the Savannah River to the Atlantic Ocean, through the Panama Canal and straight across the Pacific. 4,000 of America's toughest soldiers packed like sardines aboard the USNS Geiger. This was no pleasure cruise. We PT'd every day, most days, twice a day. No room to run, so we made up for it with intense calisthenics. Hundreds of push-ups, sit-ups, jumping jacks. We shot a lot, too. Zeroed our rifles off the fantail. On the dawn of our arrival, we geared up and climbed down rope ladders over the side of the ship, packing ourselves onto our landing craft, World War II-era LSTs. It felt like our very own D-Day. Some of the older vets who'd been there, NCOs and officers, remarked on that, the creeping sense of deja vu. We had a lot of those guys with us. A lot of World War II guys, a lot of Korean War guys, even guys who'd gone into Lebanon back in 58 when we intervened to delay a civil war with which I would become personally familiar many years later. Our brigade commander, Colonel L.V. Roberts, a future three-star general, had jumped into Normandy and Holland with the 101st Airborne, the Screaming Eagles, and fought at Bastogne. Seeing the ease of motion in those men, their cool professionalism after already experiencing the worst of war, and now coming back for more, helped flatline the nerves of some of us first-timers. Steaming away from our mothership, I reminded myself that I had learned from the best. The very men who liberated Europe kicked the North Koreans and Chi Coms back across the 38th parallel. I had served with them in two of the most legendary airborne divisions in the world, the 82nd and the 101st. Spent 3 years in Germany carrying out exercises along the 10th Special Forces Group in preparation for a Soviet invasion. Now I wanted to serve my country on the battlefield. I remembered the radio broadcasts and old newsreels of my childhood, the Allied landings, these guys, locked, loaded, and ready to take on the world. I thought of my father-in-law, Thomas Clayton Story, who'd landed in the 6th Wave at Omaha Beach, where the only cover from the hailstorm of machine gun fire were the heaps of dead American soldiers. Even in death, they shielded their own, soaking the sand and the sea red with their blood. My father-in-law told himself that if he could just make it till noon, he'd make it the rest of the day. And before I deployed, that's what he told me, sitting at his kitchen table. Just make it till noon, Jess, and you'll be okay. Now, as we bobbed and chugged through the whispering surf, I killed any urge to check my watch. We were deep into H hour, but it was still early morning. No idea what kind of welcome awaited us. Our arrival had neither the prior secrecy nor subsequent fanfare of the D-Day landings. There would be no surprise radio broadcasts to interrupt this program with a special bulletin. In announcing our imminent arrival, President Johnson might as well have taken out a full-page ad in the New York Times. America already had plenty of boots on the ground, the special forces at various forward-deployed firebases, advising the South Vietnamese, the Marines at Da Nang Air Base, there to protect U.S. aircraft from guerrilla attack, a security mission that rapidly expanded into preemptive search and destroy ops beyond their perimeter, and the Sky Soldiers of the 173rd Airborne out of Okinawa, who would suffer some of the heaviest casualties of the war. We knew our enemies were ready and waiting to greet us, though the time and place of that reception were still unknown. They were everywhere, invisible, but right smack dab in front of us, lying in wait beyond the faded ribbons of mist shifting over the emerald waters and typhoon-sculpted coastline and lush rolling hills of Quinan. Unable to see beyond the front-loading ramp of the landing craft as it cut through the water, I listened for the sounds of the beach. This was it, the final leg of our journey, to a destination that had drawn us a whole world away from the lives and loved ones that we might never encounter again, at least not in this life. Loaded down like a pack mule, armed to the teeth with my weapons and ammunition, wearing my steel pot helmet and combat boots and fatigues, I wondered if we were about to receive the same warm welcome that my father-in-law got at Normandy. Burp gun bunkers and mortar fire. His landing craft hadn't even made it to shore, and he and the others had to bail out over the sides and swim through a boiling hellfire the rest of the way. Many drowned under the weight of their own gear, metal rain pelting them to death. Our craft did make it, without any bullets plinking the hull. As the ramp came down, I prepared myself for instant and deliberate violence. Tightening my grip on my M16, I chewed at the unlit stub of the cigar in my mouth and tightened my gaze, scanning for the enemy. And I realized there were no machine guns, or mortars, or bunkers, or cyclones of lead awaiting us. As we spilled out of the craft, no red carpet of blood or blanket of bodies met our feet. The closest thing to an army we encountered was a battalion of little kids that amounted to nothing more than an aggressive sales force. Coming at us, all of them holding out makeshift hawker trays twice their size, pushing product like the stadium vendors at a ballgame. Orange soda. Fanta, Fanta! Cheap, cheap! Then my ears caught a transistor radio playing somewhere, all tinny and full of static. Radio Saigon. And I could have sworn I heard the faint echoes of Bobby Helms singing My Special Angel. Right then, I thought of my sweet Judith. That was our song. Maybe I was just imagining it, my mind playing tricks on me. Or playing tricks on me now, all these years later, as I try to remember. But I was only thinking of her. Judith, my high school sweetheart. The one true love of my life. Back home in Arkansas, chasing after our 4-year-old daughter, Tammy, while pregnant with our next. Bright-eyed and full of faith, she'd kissed me goodbye as I went off to war. I held that memory now like treasure, and never felt so far away from home. The fact was, I wanted Vietnam. I had requested it. I was still with the Screaming Eagles of the 101st when a staff sergeant buddy of mine found out that the 1st Cavalry Division was looking to load up on NCOs for its newly formed Airborne Brigade. We went to our lieutenant colonel, who'd already been to Vietnam as an advisor and married a Vietnamese woman. He got on the horn to division. I got these two young guys here who are just dying to go to combat. Now there's an interesting turn of phrase. So I'm going to give you their names, and you just get them out there. To give my best in battle was not just a job. It was my duty to protect my country, my family, my wife, my daughter, my unborn child, my brother soldiers. More than anyone, Judith knew that going in. She'd be the first to tell you as much, too. My country needed me. That's all there was to it. I didn't care about politics. The biggest political lesson this war would teach me was just how apolitical Mr. Kalashnikov's infamous AK-47 assault rifle was on the battlefield. It couldn't have cared less who it was killing, or who used it to do that killing. War only discriminated between the living and the dead. Sergeant Johnson, drop and give me 100! Ah, shit. The distinctive bark belonged to our battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Mertel, who'd done 2 tours in Korea commanding a rifle company. As we all sat waiting on that beach under the dragon-tongued far eastern sun, I'd made the terrible mistake.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?